call the Senate State Affairs Committee to order. Let the record show that reflect that it's August 10th, 2009, and the time is 10:35. Present at the table is Vice Chair Senator Kevin Meyer, Senator Passan, Senator French, and I am Senator Menard. I'd like to introduce my staff, Marilyn Lane, my chief of staff, as well as Michael Revito, Chuck Heath, and Brian Timlin, and Sarah Munson. They're all here with me today, and I thank them for that. On the agenda today, we have one item, the confirmation of Lieutenant General Craig Campbell as the Lieutenant Governor. My intention for this meeting is to hear from Mr. Campbell and take time for the members of this committee to question the nominee. In the interest of time, I'd like to keep all conversations on topic so we can forward our decision to the legislature. Public testimony will take place after the committee members have asked their questions. Again, we are limited on time today. If you took the elevator up, you saw that little disclosure there. So I'm giving each person 3 minutes to testify. I want to give as many people as I can the allotted time. Committee members, everybody have their cell phones turned off? Okay. Is there any business to come before the committee before we get started? Senator Meyer.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, before we get started, I just wanted the committee to be aware and the public that my wife, Marty Meyer, works for General Campbell as a special assistant. And I do intend to declare a potential conflict of interest on the floor during our joint session later this afternoon.
Thank you, and I expect you to participate in discussion. Okay, thank you. Is there any objections, members of the room? Okay, thank you. So let's get started. First, Mr. Campbell, I want to thank you for your service for the United States government, and I admire your commitment to our country as well as our state of Alaska. Moving ahead, Mr. Campbell, would you like to make an opening statement for us?
Thank you, Madam Chairman and members of the committee, and thank you for taking the time today to have this meeting to discuss my candidacy for Lieutenant Governor for the state of Alaska. I'm honored to be here, looking forward to the opportunity to serve our citizens in the role of Lieutenant Governor. Before I get started, I'd like to introduce my family, because this is pretty historic for everybody, including the Campbell family. And so most of you know my wife, Anne Marie, who is second row on the end, and next to Anne Marie is my youngest daughter, Amanda, and next to her is my granddaughter, Emma, who belongs to the next lady, which is my oldest daughter, Melanie. You can see I had a wife, two daughters, and I have four granddaughters, so already I know I'm outnumbered in this process, but they wanted to come to watch this today, and I'm very appreciative of the support they've provided over the number of years that they've been involved in my political life. I guess I'm not going to spend a long time with opening comments. I suspect you all know me from seeing me down in the legislature the last 6.5 years, and you know how I've worked at the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs. That record's pretty transparent, and I thank you for the support you've provided that department in the last 6.5 years. In my opinion, it's a rock-solid department that held the cost and held our budget the last 3 years, and we did what you asked us to do, and we didn't come to supplementals except for disaster relief and a few oddball things like that. But in all, I think the department was well-managed, well-led, and the people there were doing an outstanding job with what you entrusted them to do. So I'm not going to spend a lot of time talking about that. That record really is on the record. What I would like to do is just reflect a little more of what I've done in life other than the military, because I even see some of the resume out here has my military picture, and so much of the last 6.5 years, people start thinking, well, this guy's just a military guy. Why would we have a military guy be lieutenant governor? And for those of you that haven't looked into my background to a large degree, you'll know that I moved here in 1981. I was in the Air Force, and the Air Force gave me the option of moving to St. Louis, Missouri, where the mountains aren't quite as high as they are in Alaska, and I opted to get out of the Air Force and stay in Alaska, and I joined the Guard. But I did that as a weekender, a part-time Guard member. I did that the majority of my life in the National Guard until this last stint for the 6.5 years where I was the Adjutant General. And as a part-timer, that was one small part of my life. A larger part of my life was earning a living as an airport planner, doing airport planning work, environmental work, noise work. I worked at a plethora of airports around the state of Alaska, from Ketchikan to Bethel, ANIAC, to Looksack, and a bunch of others, done some work at Anchorage International. But I also had the chance to work at SeaTac, Ann Arbor, Michigan, and many other airports in the lower 48, including some overseas work in Kazakhstan. So I spent a lot of time working in the private sector for a number of companies and on my own doing the airport work and aviation work. I'm a licensed pilot, no longer active. I'm a licensed air traffic controller, no longer active. So my heart is in aviation. I love what we do in Alaska. I love the aviation aspect of Alaska. And that provided my basic income that I earned as a civilian while I did my National Guard time. But public service has also been part of my life since I was a young boy and I went to college and I took political science, and some of the courses there that inspired me were constitutional law of government and studying what the structure of democracy in a republic really is. So when I came to Alaska, one of the reasons I also got out of the military was I saw this as a land of opportunity. And I got out in 1984, and in 1986 I was elected to the Anchorage Assembly, where I served 9.5 years. And that was a very rewarding time. I served the Eagle River Chugiak area. 1986, when I got elected, just to reflect back for everybody who is here remembers it, we were right at the bubble had burst. The economy was going to heck. And there was about 2,000 homes in foreclosure in Anchorage. Housing values were down 25% to 40%. And that's why I ran for the assembly. I figured public services, government has to help fix this problem. And so I served on the assembly for those 9.5 years, twice as chairman, and left that job feeling very comfortable that I had served our city very well. I didn't end there, though. I moved on to the Matanuska Electric Association co-op board. I did that for 3 years. That is a different world than being on the assembly. Local politics is very good, but a co-op for the electric company has some very interesting dynamics with that. I enjoyed that, did that for a while, but at that point I moved on, and Mayor George Wirtz at the time invited me to come work for the municipality full-time, and I spent about 2.5 years reorganizing, planning, development, traffic, what we were doing, and trying to make the city of Anchorage more user-friendly for those that wanted to develop, while also protecting the environmental restrictions and the permitting requirements that would make it so it's a good city. Most of us have been in Anchorage a long time recognize that we've evolved in a very scattered way, and sometimes our zoning codes weren't quite as firm as they could be. You can have a very nice property next to not so nice a property. You have industrial, residential all mixed together, and we tried to sort that out. And one of my proudest moments for working for George Wirtz is when we were able to pass the Comp Plan 2010 for the city of Anchorage, which mixed the neighborhood interest along with the development interest. So I really just wanted to spend a few minutes going over that. So you're well aware that my background is much more than military. In fact, I'd say the military side is probably on a minority side of what my experiences in Alaska have been, both in the private sector and the political world. So with that, I will certainly open it to questions. Anything you would like, Madam Chair.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Campbell. Now I'll allow the committee members to ask questions of the nominee. Do any committee members have any questions? Senator French.
Thanks, Madam Chair. I'll go ahead and get started. It's nice to have you here, and I need to know how to address you today. So before we get started, are you Commissioner, are you Mr. Campbell, are you General Campbell, or how should we...
I'm going to take the safe one, Senator, through the chair. I'm going to say Craig is the best way, because I am the temporary substitute lieutenant governor. I'm still in the military. That retirement date doesn't take effect till the end of the month, pending confirmation.
I see. Maybe I'll call you Mr. Campbell, just to keep
that's
it on
a, that's okay. Also
okay.
Good.
I don't want, you know, that, and that'll work. We are under a fairly compressed schedule today. And so we're going to probably focus on just one or two topics, at least for me, and I don't know what the other committee members have in mind. But it's a little bit unusual because, of course, we're not really confirming you to be the lieutenant governor's successor. You're going to be, upon our action, lieutenant governor, and potentially next in line to be the governor of the state of Alaska. So it's a little more high stakes, I think, than when we spoke to Mr. Schmidt last year and did his confirmation hearing. The thing I want to ask you about is, and maybe Mr. Rovito can help me. I've got one little thing I'd like to pass out to the members of the committee and to you, Mr. Campbell. And it's an ICER study that was done on federal spending here in the state of Alaska. And I'm sure you know from your history that it's a big part of our economy. Thousands of jobs rely on that spending. And I want to ask you about a remark you made when the other half of the reason we're here today, of course, is about the stimulus override and so forth. In a couple of news reports, you referred to that as a bribe, and I want to ask you, you know, what does that, the use of that word, what does that say about what we're doing, and how do you feel about that?
Through the chair, Senator, thank you for raising that, because I don't always trust the media's reporting the whole story. Sometimes they pick the part that reads best, and I did say that. I'm not disputing with the media that I, when asked at the House Judiciary Committee about stimulus package and federal monies, that I was concerned when federal monies appear to be a bribe. And I think all of us need to be, because the fine point that we have in government is how much do we do things that are our choice and how much do we do things that are really other people's choice and we're just infatuated by the dollars attached to it. And I'm a very conservative individual when it comes to government. You probably read some of my history on the Anchorage Assembly, where I was usually a no vote on the growth of government, and we were trying to keep the cost down and therefore the size of government down. And so just because the federal government offers us money does not mean we should accept it just because it's federal money. You need to look and see what are the strings or other things that might be attached that require you to do something that normally you may not want to do, but the money is so attractive that, yeah, you're willing to do it. I would argue seatbelts, to some degree, are still should be an individual choice. But all states and societies generally realize that, you know, it's tied to road money, it's tied to a lot of other things that we want, and so therefore we require seatbelts to be worn as opposed to allowing individuals to have the choice of seatbelts. To a degree, I would argue that that is the federal government trying to have us do something that maybe we wouldn't do ourselves. That could be considered a bribe to me when we are accepting something to do something that we would not intend to do simply to get the money.
I've got two or three more questions on that, and I'll be finished. Thanks, Madam Chair. For many people, the word bribe connotes illegality. That's sort of the way that most people use it in life. If you're bribed to do something, it's because you're doing something you shouldn't do or you wouldn't do, on your own volition. And so I just find that a little bit disturbing that we're talking about the cell phone's ringing.
Not mine, sir.
About bribes when it comes to federal spending, especially in Alaska. And I'm worried about the message it sends back to Washington. Given the tens of thousands of jobs that are in this state that are dependent on federal spending, federal officials in Washington will make a decision in the future about the aid that comes to the state. And I just wonder whether we're sending the sort of signal that's remarkably uningratiating and potentially hurtful to the many, many Alaskans who depend on that federal spending when we use that word instead of maybe a different, more neutral term.
Through the chair, Senator, I understand your perspective. My experience in 35 years with government work on the federal, state, and local level is I doubt that there's those in Washington that would look at Alaska and say, because Craig Campbell said the word bribe associated with federal money, that we're not going to allow opportunities for Alaska to participate in federal programs that our senators and our congressmen and the federal government's pursuing. In fact, I think that's a non-issue. The federal government is interested in providing funds for purposes in states, and we, through our legislature, through the executive branch, and through our congressional delegation, will review whether it's the right thing to do. I will be a conservative voice suggesting that we always look at, is there a reason why we should accept this money? And if it's not a valid reason for Alaskans, I would be the voice that would probably be saying that maybe we should reconsider that.
And just one or two more, Madam Chair. The ICER report that I asked to be sent out notes that one-third of all jobs in Alaska can be traced to federal spending here, that federal spending in Alaska more than doubled between 1995 and 2005, and in 2006 it was $9.25 billion. By now, federal spending here has stopped growing. Many Alaskans are worried that the economy is vulnerable to spending cuts as the federal budget tightens. It goes on to say that this analysis estimates that Alaska could be vulnerable to federal spending cuts in the range of $450 million to $1.25 billion, which could cost the economy anywhere from 7,000 to 20,000 jobs in the future. And as a person who lives and invests and has a big stake in the Anchorage economy, that concerns me. And I would hope it would concern the top policymakers in the state. And so I would encourage you, as you think about your new role in life, to use more neutral terms when it comes to describing federal spending in the state of Alaska. I think the word bribe is not a good word to use, that it connotes illegality and that it connotes something illicit. And to me, the fact that this state has long been dependent on federal dollars from its very inception, if not before, should put us in a position of being willing to have this discussion on honest and tough policy decisions without veering into terms like that that are so charged. And so that's my request to you before I vote on your confirmation.
Well, through the chair, Senator, I accept your guidance. I really do. That's part of what this process is. And you know me for the last number of years as one that is a give and take and certainly always willing to accept guidance where I can improve.
And I want to ask you about a remark you made when the other half of the reason we're here today, of course, is about the stimulus override and so forth. In a couple of news reports, you referred to that.
Muted.
And I want to ask you, what does that, the use of that word, what does that say about what we're doing and how do you feel about that?
Through the chair, Senator, thank you for raising that because I don't always trust the media's reporting the whole story. Sometimes they pick the part that reads best. And I did say that. I'm not disputing with the media that when asked at the House Judiciary Committee about stimulus package and federal monies, that I was concerned when federal monies appear to be a bribe. And I think all of us need to be. Because the fine point that we have in government is how much do we do things that are our choice and how much do we do things that are really other people's choice and we're just infatuated by the dollars attached to it. And I'm a very conservative individual when it comes to government. You probably read some of my history on the Anchorage Assembly where I was usually a no vote on the growth of government and we were trying to keep the cost down and therefore the size of government down. And so just because the federal government offers us money does not mean we should accept it just because it's federal money. You need to look and see what are the strings or other things that might be attached that require you to do something that normally you may not want to do, but the money is so attractive that, yeah, you're willing to do it. I would argue seatbelts, to some degree, are still should be an individual choice. But all states and societies generally realize that, you know, it's tied to road money, it's tied to a lot of other things that we want, and so, therefore, we require seatbelts to be worn as opposed to allowing individuals to have the choice of seatbelts. To a degree, I would argue that that is the federal government trying to have us do something that maybe we wouldn't do ourselves. That could be considered a bribe to me when we are accepting something to do something that we would not intend to do simply to get the money.
I've got two or three more questions on that, and I'll be finished. Thanks, Madam Chair. For many people, the word bribe connotes illegality. That's sort of the way that most people use it in life. If you're bribed to do something, it's because you're doing something you shouldn't do or you wouldn't do, on your own volition. And so I just find that a little bit disturbing that we're talking about cell phone's ringing.
Not mine, sir.
About bribes when it comes to federal spending, especially in Alaska. And I'm worried about the message it sends back to Washington, given the tens of thousands of jobs that are in this state that are dependent on federal spending. Federal officials in Washington will make a decision in the future about the aid that comes to the state, and I just wonder whether we're sending the sort of signal that's remarkably uningratiating and potentially hurtful to the many, many Alaskans who depend on that federal spending when we use that word instead of maybe a different, more neutral term.
Through the chair, Senator, I understand your perspective. My experience in 35 years with government work on the federal, state, and local level is I doubt that there's those in Washington that would look at Alaska and say, because Craig Campbell said the word bribe associated with federal money, that we're not going to allow opportunities for Alaska to participate in federal programs that our senators and our congressmen and the federal government's pursuing. In fact, I think that's a non-issue. The federal government is interested in providing funds for purposes in states, and we, through our legislature, through the executive branch, and through our congressional delegation, will review whether it's the right thing to do. I will be a conservative voice suggesting that we always look at, is there a reason why we should accept this money? And if it's not a valid reason for Alaskans, I would be the voice that would probably be saying that maybe we should reconsider that.
And just one or two more, Madam Chair, thank you. The ICER report that I asked to be sent out notes that one-third of all jobs in Alaska can be traced to federal spending here, that federal spending in Alaska more than doubled between 1995 and 2005, and in 2006 it was $9.25 billion. By now, federal spending here has stopped growing. Many Alaskans are worried that the economy is vulnerable to spending cuts as the federal budget tightens. It goes on to say that this analysis estimates that Alaska could be vulnerable to federal spending cuts in the range of $450 million to $1.25 billion, which could cost the economy anywhere from 7,000 to 20,000 jobs in the future. And as a person who lives and invests and has a big stake in the Anchorage economy, that concerns me. And I would hope it would concern the top policymakers in the state. And so I would encourage you, as you think about your new role in life, to use more neutral terms when it comes to describing federal spending in the state of Alaska. I think the word bribe is not a good word to use, that it connotes illegality and that it connotes something illicit. And to me, the fact that this state has long been dependent on federal dollars from its very inception, if not before, should put us in a position of being willing to have this discussion on honest and tough policy decisions without veering into terms like that that are so charged. And so that's my request to you before I vote on your confirmation.
Well, through the chair, Senator, I accept your guidance. I really do. That's part of what this process is. And you know me for the last number of years as one that is a give and take and certainly always willing to accept guidance where I can improve myself. With that, I will still go back, though, and say I, too, support federal funding for purposes in Alaska. I mean, Alaska has done very good and has required a lot of federal funding. I would not suggest that my comments would be inferred that I don't want federal funding. What I do want us to do is make sure that it's in Alaska's best interest when we receive federal funding. What I would like us to do, as I've stated a number of times, is expand our economy beyond just federal jobs and federal money. A growth of the economy of Alaska, where Alaskans have jobs earning Alaskan income for Alaskan purposes, is both of our goals. But I will accept your guidance. I appreciate that.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. And thank you, Mr. Campbell, for your statement. I just respectfully want to recognize Senator Johnny Ellis is at the table with us, and we appreciate having him, as well as many, many legislators in the office in the front, where we have Representative Lindsey Holmes and Nancy Dahlstrom and Senator Fred Dyson, and I would just take up all our time if I went row by row. So just know that I'm very appreciative that you consider this an important enough issue to come and attend this hearing as well. Thank you. Are there any other questions from committee members? Yes, Senator Passfan.
Thank you, Senator Menard. Mr. Campbell, you were talking in your opening presentation about your attitudes on the growth of government. And the question that I have is, do you support privatization of such things as public police and fire, public libraries, public schools? You know, what is your attitude as far as privatization of government?
Through the chair, Senator, a number of different answers, because you lumped a number of different things in that question. So, you know, let me start with police and fire. Police is a function of government, and I believe that policing should be done by local police, state police, and those that are entrusted through government to do our law enforcement. Fire could be, in some aspects, privatized. It has been done in other communities, and I think it's a legitimate one to look at. But not necessarily that I'm saying all fire protection should be privatized. It's one that I recommended looking at back when I was on the Anchorage Assembly. Schools, I believe, should have a variety of choices. I believe the public education system has to be, must be, paid for by the public, and we must have a public school system, but we also should encourage private school systems in the state, because that gives us the diversity and gives citizens a choice as to what they want for raising their kids. When it comes to libraries, libraries are a public function and a private function. Through the Internet and through the way technology is going today, there's much more access than there is going to a library. So there is an open discussion as to how much needs to be a public library aspect and resources from other aspects that you can have as a library function. And I would be very open to that discussion. Let's get to utilities, though. I was a strong advocate for privatizing utilities in the city of Anchorage. I fought and tried to get the Anchorage telephone utility privatized. It reached a value. We had a bidder that was going to put in $500 million to buy the Anchorage telephone utility. It was turned down by the assembly. I was on the losing side of that vote. A few years later, after I was off the assembly, we finally privatized ATU. At $250 million, it had lost half its value. And today, as you see from the telephone utilities and what we're doing in technology around the state, that was a good decision to privatize it. My disappointment is we sold it for such a low price. When you're going to privatize, you should maximize the investment for the citizens that invested in that as a public utility. We didn't with ATU.
Specifically with yes, Senator. You know, with the police and fire departments, you know, I look at that as being part of public safety, and what I'm trying to understand is why you would differentiate within the realm of public safety between police and fire.
Through the chair, sir, there are some functions that the fire department provides, such as ambulance service, that can be done by other private sectors. And I think you can look at the fire department, you can divide some of their responsibilities, and those could be privatized. I'm not suggesting, and I don't want the record to reflect, that the firefighter that's in the station to run the engine out to a fire should be privatized.
Do you believe that public libraries should be subsidized by the people of Alaska?
Through the chair, to the extent that we have public libraries, public participation through tax dollars should be invested in libraries.
I guess focusing on that qualifier, to the extent that we have public libraries, that's what I'm trying to find out, is whether you ultimately would say you would not want to have public libraries.
Through the chair, Senator, I think I've already answered that question. I think I said I do believe in public libraries and that there is a role for the public to pay for libraries. So if I didn't make it clear enough, I apologize.
Okay, any follow-up?
Mm-hmm.
Follow-up?
Yes.
Senator
Pascan. Yes. I read one of the articles from a decade ago or so, and it dealt with restrictions on groups of people working in food service or the healthcare field. And what I was wondering is whether you continue to advocate for barriers to Alaskans who are gay working in schools or the healthcare field or food service.
Through the chair, to Senator, I believe those issues have already been resolved in the state of Alaska, and I don't have any conflict with where we are today.
Okay, follow up.
Sure. Do you believe that the oil and gas industry should be taxed beyond what it takes for government to monitor the industry?
Through the chair, Senator, that's a kind of a complicated question, much more than it appears on the surface. The taxing of the oil industry should be fair and equitable to the oil industry and to the citizens of Alaska. We are the owners of the resources. We, the people of Alaska, are owners of the resources. The oil companies need to pay their fair share of what they are extracting from Alaska, which is ours, to sell on the open market. I think, though, that we have probably reached a fairly good balance with the oil companies with the tax system we have today. Now, whether that means they're taxing, we are taxing for beyond what we do just the oil companies and taxing to provide other services, that's okay, because those are our resources, and they are now making profits from the sale of our resources. And so I wouldn't suggest, and I don't think I ever have suggested, that oil taxes should be restricted to only what is the effect of the oil industry.
If I may.
Follow up.
What I'm concerned with is when it comes to government taxation. Now, certainly there are some federal resources or there are non-state resources that the oil industry is developing. And what my question, maybe a more focused question, is whether there should be a, in your mind, taxation beyond what it takes to regulate or monitor the industry if the resource came from a non-state-owned site.
Through the chair, I apologize if I'm not quite understanding the question, so let me give you another take at my answer, and if it doesn't hit right, ask me again.
I could clarify. In other words, you know, income taxes, because they're operating within the state, you know, they're using our roads, all of those types of things, you know, should, but beyond whether government is just monitoring and regulating the industry, do you believe that the oil and gas industry should be taxed beyond what it takes just to do those minimal levels?
Through the chair, thank you for the clarification. I got it. And let me start with a large world view of the world as I look at taxes. I don't look at a local tax or a state tax or a federal tax or an excise tax versus sales tax versus income tax and divide them. I look at what is the tax burden against the citizen. And you'll see in some states the tax burden against the citizen is over 50% now, which means more than half of what they make goes to government, whether it's boroughs, county, local, state, federal, doesn't really matter. Over 50% of what some people are making in some states goes to government, and I don't think that's right. I think we should try to minimize the tax burden on citizens and allow citizens to take their money and invest it where they want. That's what makes a prosperous society. Now, with that said, I do not believe that we should limit taxes to the lowest level just for the purposes of the oil industry, for the oil industry, for monitoring, regulating, etc. I'll give you an example. When I was on the Anchorage Assembly, Eaglewood Subdivision is in Eagle River. I represented that area. And they were exempt from the road service. So they were not paying any road service tax to the city of Anchorage at all. But the only roads they took care of were within the Eaglewood Subdivision.
I had an issue with that. They drove on the roads of Anchorage, Eagle River. They used our roads in many ways. They used our services. So I felt there's a prorated tax rate they should be paying to the greater good of the people. And we instituted a new law, a new tax that Eaglewood paid a reduced road tax, but they are now paying and have been paying a road tax for the services they receive beyond their road service. So I believe and would support a tax program that looks at the total burden of the citizen as well as what the obligations of the state are, and we all participate in that. So it's beyond just what the oil industry would be providing. We would be providing to the oil industry for regulation and monitoring.
Okay.
Possibly a little bit later.
Okay. Thank you, Senator Pasquin. Senator Myers, do you have any questions? Okay. I had just one question. What do you intend to do to prepare for the next step, should you have to step in as governor?
Madam Chair, that would be a very interesting step to take, because the law would require that my first action would be to declare an election to elect a governor, because I would be a non-elected governor. And as the Constitution and the statutes require, we can't have that. In this role, as a non-elected lieutenant governor for an elected individual, Sean Parnell, who was elected as lieutenant governor moving to governor, he can hold that role. I couldn't. So my real steps would be in preparing to make sure I know through my job as lieutenant governor on the elections, running division of elections, and what we're doing on the election process to make sure we legally declare the next election to elect who the next governor would be.
Thank you. I wasn't real clear. I meant in case there was a tragedy and you had to initially, you have to kind of have that in your head. How would you prepare yourself?
Madam Chair, I've known Governor Parnell for a long time. In fact, I served on the Anchorage Assembly with his father. And so I've watched Governor Parnell grow up through the legislature, and he's been a good friend for a number of years. And we're already working very closely together. So I believe with a short period of time, I will be able to understand the direction that he is taking our government. And as what I would consider then a very interim governor, I would not be making changes to the Parnell plan. I would be forcing the election process to now find a governor who would be elected to then set their agenda for Alaska.
Okay. Thank you very much for the answer. Is there any other members? Senator French.
Just a couple follow-ups based on some of the questions that Senator Pasquin asked. Thank you. School vouchers. Would you support a school voucher program that allowed citizens to take the money that they're sort of allocated, if you will, through the process and use that as a voucher to go to a private school?
Through the chair, Senator, I do.
And back to oil taxes, sort of like a yes or no, do you feel that currently our oil taxation system needs changing or not?
Through the chair, I do not.
Thank you.
Are there any more questions?
Yes, Senator Menard.
Okay. Senator Pasquin.
You know, I appreciate your, in your opening remarks, kind of going beyond the military, and you were focusing upon your work in airports throughout the state and kind of using that as an analogy. You know, while I was aware of you certainly from Juneau, I don't know that I know you. In other words, you weren't on the radar screen for a position of lieutenant governor, you know, of an important position within the executive branch. And, you know, obviously here a number of weeks ago I had forwarded a letter to you saying, you know, look, I really don't know you. Yes, we've met, and yes, I'm aware of you. And, you know, requesting information from you, and your response to me basically said, I'm not going to give you anything. And, you know, so I'm kind of wondering, is that a type of working relationship that you believe with the legislature in general, or how is it that we can address that issue? Because I don't know you.
Senator, through the chair, Senator, if you have that letter, you might want to share it with everybody, because I don't believe that I said I'm not going to provide information. I believe the letter was clear. And this is probably a good start to how I work with the legislature. My answer was that you asked for a lot of stuff. I mean, campaign stuff from 20 years ago that I don't have. You asked for a lot of information that's archived with the city clerk or other places that I don't keep track of. So I believe that I actually directed you as to where you could get that information, if it is still available at all. Like the annual report that I did for the municipality, I believe that is available on their website. And I don't have one, but there's one available that the public can look at, and it would give you a real good breakdown of what I did while I was the executive director over there. So I apologize if I appeared to kind of brush you off. That wasn't my intent. My intent was to give you guidance on where you really could get the right information with no concern that I might be filtering it, that everything that's out there you'd have access to.
Thank you. Yes, and just to follow up with what Senator Passman, typically the committee members are accustomed to, when there is a confirmation hearing, to do maybe put it in the word of lobbying a little bit. You know, call us or you say, you know, is there any questions you have? And that didn't take place. So I think that's kind of pertinent to what Senator Pascavan was saying. So are there any more questions from any more committee members? Okay, I'm going to close the question period. And we'll do that. And I want to then, I'd like to open this up to public comment. We'll go to the list of people who have signed up to test it. Just for everybody in the audience, we do have packets here of information that we've received pro and con from the Lieutenant Governor Craig Campbell's successor, right? His successee, I think we're supposed to title it. So anyway, moving on now to, we have a Paul Kendall from Anchorage representing Queen Electric. Paul, are you here? Would you please come and state your name and your affiliation, please, for their record?
Thank you so much for staying.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Paul Kendall, and I'd like to convey my turn to somebody more accomplished in the community who knows him more in more regard than I do, if there's such a person, so he can expedite things. Having made that conveyance and nobody taking advantage of it, I've only dealt with Mr. Campbell briefly. I think whenever the governor declared some type of emergency when the Snettisham Dam went down and prices were high and she called for an emergency meeting. And I think I had a brief discussion with him on the phone. He sounded like an honorable man with me, and so I have no differences with the gentleman. Instead, I came here to try to, if I could, propound or promote a perspective about energy. I would hope that the Lieutenant Governor would keep in mind that Alaska is at the forefront of a new day and era. And if you go to alaskaoceanpower.blogspot.com, it is not for talking. It is a data compilation point. And you will notice in there that over 50 manufacturers of electric vehicles are breaching within the next 3 years. The electrification of America is well on its way. 70% of our oil is used for transportation. We are now about to see a paradigm of which I've never witnessed in my entire life as an old energy advocate. And I think that our leaders, if I hear anybody talk about privatizing our energy, I'm going to be very concerned. I think we've been there, done that. I never want my people's energy, which is clean electricity and water. I never, ever want that again. Yes.
If you can just keep this kind of on point.
Sure.
Testify for Mr. Campbell, please,
sure.
On his behalf.
And I forgot to bring my clock, but I'll conclude with simply this, if I might. And I would hope that Mr. Campbell, being a leader in the military who looks out for all of our benefits, will realize that the young people are about to realize that energy is integral to our very existence and everything that we do in our society. And that from now on, no individual, no corporation, no country will ever, ever own our electricity and water for our dwellings, of which we house our families and loved ones. And I thank you for the opportunity to take up the board's time, and congratulations, Mr. Campbell, and his lovely family. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Kendall. Next, we have Robert Goodman. Robert, from Anchorage, would you come state your name, please, and your affiliation? And you have also dropped off numerous a packet for
yes, I have. I've given you some files. What I've given you is the files
you
from
your
July.
Name for the record, please.
My name is Bob Goodman, Robert A. Goodman.
Thank you.
The files are accumulation of up to the present about the Territorial Guard. For the record, I'm a 78-year-old male with over 40 years of military experience in personnel and administration field, with 32 years in the Alaska National Guard. When I come before you today, I'm like a mosquito attacking an elephant. Because of General Campbell's record with each of you, most of you have known General Campbell for many years, worked with him, and believed him to be an honorable man who performed in a superior manner, accomplishing everything with ease. A man whose list of accomplishments are great, General Campbell gives a superb presentation no matter what the subject. He always stayed within his budget, even at a great expense to our Territorial Guard members. I too believed in General Campbell at one time. He had my support and loyalty. That all changed when on 6 January 06, I called him for help to obtain the ATG veterans their discharges in the least amount of time. On 3 December 05, only 68 discharges had been issued, and I had provided 74% of them. All veterans due money should have had their discharge in hand. He made me an offer, and I could not accept it, so I called him and told him I could not accept his offer. He said, I don't have any money to support the ATG program. I told him, you can submit a supplemental. And General Campbell said, it's not one of my priorities, concluding the call. Remember, these are World War II veterans, are in their 80s plus, and this is a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. 53% of these veterans were from Nome Kotzebue area. All of these veterans should have been ID'd and discharged by 31 December 05 and submitted for pay due of approximately $2,300,000 in back pay for these 54 as of 9 August 2009. All of us knows this is real money. This is why the Army stopped their pay, and you needed to pass a law to pay until the new law goes into effect in 1 October 09. Had General Campbell submitted them for pay as the discharges were issued, they would not. This would not have happened. So I talked with the governor. Since that time, General Campbell has been deceitful and deceptive and has shown a complete lack of integrity when dealing with me concerning the ATG issue. Now, when the person at the top lacks integrity, it affects the whole organization working that project, and in this case, it is filtered into the Department of Administrative Retirement section, the Department of Law, because their reaction to my request for ruling concerning State of Alaska military pay. These World War II veterans still have not been paid their state retirement pay of as much as $6,200, which could have been paid shortly after General Campbell signed the request for discharge. On 18 October 04, Senator Lisa Murkowski presented the first discharge to Sam Herman. General Campbell stated, it was a disgrace his members passed away without being recognized, Campbell said. I am elated to announce that from this point on there will never be another Alaskan who doesn't receive the appropriate recognition. Ma'am?
If you could just wrap it up. You're close.
Yeah, well, I've got about a minute and a half left.
I'm sorry. It's a 3 minute.
Well, you see, I'm the last one to testify.
No, I have someone else on.
Well, there was only two on the list. But
we have teleconferences, sir. If you can wrap it up, just I'll give you a chance to do kind of close.
He had a simple task to identify all of ATG members and their surviving spouses, and he had access to a roster with 339 names and addresses. Just about all were living ATG veterans who could have been entitled to benefits. It took him, organization of 5,000 people, approximately 6.5 years to identify 54 people, due approximately $2 million. General Campbell's Assistant Secretary Army and Tribal Liaison Officer traveled to 34 villages from 18 October 04 to 31 July 07 and never obtained one ATG application because it wasn't one of their priorities. Many ATG members could have been submitted for pay beginning in June of 05. 28 still have not received their back pay.
Could you just please close the testimony?
You see, I've just about finished. I'm trying to make a point here. And I understand your procedures, right. And you choose. I just have about 2 minutes left. If you would indulge, I would appreciate it.
Everybody coming forward could say they're representing other people and need 15
you
minutes.
You see, I've got signatures in my deal for 18 people from the bush that have authorized me to act in their behalf. I'm trying to make the point that they've lost thousands of dollars, and you choose not to give me 2 minutes to finish what I've got to say.
I'm sorry. I'm ruling that your testimony will have to come to a close.
Okay. Well, General Campbell violated the state military code by appointing an officer as assistant AG who didn't have 5 years of service in the Alaska National Guard. General Campbell violated the state military code by reassigning the commander of the state defense force under the assistant AG.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Goodman. Is there anyone else in the audience that would like to, I'm giving anyone that did not sign up an opportunity to come forward. Would you like to come forward and state your name and affiliation for the record? Thank you, Mr. Goodman.
You're more than welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. My name is Clyde Baxley. I'm a private citizen retired from the freight business here in Anchorage. I had no intentions of testifying until I heard Mr. Campbell talk about government. And he, what I take umbrage with is his attitude toward taxes, cost of government, and so forth. And he referred to taxes and so forth as a burden on children, us, and future generations. And to me, that's a misplaced concept that Mr. Campbell, in all fairness to Mr. Campbell, he's not the only one that carries this idea around with him. But taxes are meant to pay for people for services that they receive. And for the most part, my experience has been that government services are not provided to people until they ask for them. And then when the services come down the pike, then they're asked, you know, the taxes are used to pay for these services. So it's not really a burden. I don't feel like it's a burden for my taxes to go for services that I receive. I'm very willing to pay for the services that I get. And I'm sorry that Mr. Campbell chooses to look at it differently. And I would hope that the people in the community, every community, from the local level on up to the national level, understands that taxes are used to pay for services that citizens get. And they get services that they ask for. And basically that's my comment about Mr. Campbell and his attitude toward taxes and his government service. I'm sorry that he has such a poor opinion of government. I don't. I think government serves a very useful and necessary purpose, and I wish Mr. Campbell would share that attitude. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Seeing no one's coming forward, I only think it's fair that I allow Mr. Campbell to come forward and address the territorial issue for just 3 minutes, please, and the taxes, if you could just wrap that up. And then I'll go to two online and see if you can resolve this.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I'll deal with the second one first, which is taxes. And I didn't mean to convey that I don't believe in government. There is a core reason we have government, and I do support that. And to have government, you must tax. The burden I referred to, especially when I talked about over 50% burden on some states where citizens are paying more to government than they keep for themselves, is what my concern is. What is that balance? At what point are we providing more than we as government should provide, and is there other means that it could be provided from? So that's all. I do respect government. I've been in it a long time, and I understand that we do need to tax to provide some services. The Alaska Territorial Guard, most of you are very familiar with the history of that, and Senator Stevens passed a law around 2000 that allowed us to then bring the Territorial Guard members into the military for discharge purposes. Up till then, it had been 60 years since World War II, and they hadn't even been recognized as veterans. When that passed, nothing really had been done until I became the commissioner under the Murkowski administration. We did start the program. I hired Mr. Goodman as my staff officer to do that. He did start the program, and as he reflected, he then didn't believe the terms are good enough for him, so he left my service, and so I then brought in others who have been excelling at what it's done. He mentioned that in the first 2 years we only did about 75 or so, and he's probably correct. That was the period of time Mr. Goodman was involved in the project, and you'll notice since that period of time, the last couple of years, is well over 1,000. It's about 1,500, I believe, so far. I have a good team that's working at about 3 individuals. We have outreach across the state, troopers through the, whenever they're traveling, they advertise for that. The tribal councils and the communities are helping us receiving discharge packets. We have the names of all 6,600 plus, and we are trying to contact their families. It was unfortunate when the federal government decided they were not going to pay the discharge benefits, and that really put a lot of work effort into now going back to the federal government and saying no. They're entitled to that. They deserve that. And I do appreciate the work of our congressional delegation, especially Senator Begich, who pushed hard to get this put back into law where the federal government is going to pay the retirement benefits to those from the ATG. So there have been a lot of ups and downs. You know, we don't need to go into all the details other than the fact that I think in the last 2.5 years, we've had a very successful program. We are doing certificates programs in communities across the state to the point where later this month, General Renuart, the 4-star commander of Northern Command, is going to be here, and he wants to go do one up in Barrow. So this has national interest. It's being worked very hard, and I'm very proud of the people that are doing the work today.
Thank you. I sincerely thank you for coming back up.
Thank you.
Well, just, I want to go ahead with...
follow up on that. Because
okay, Senator French.
Thank you. We've got a little extra time. Can you just tell me sort of what the steps are for finding, locating, and then sort of processing, or whatever verb it is you use, the Territorial Guard members, how many there might be, how many we've signed up, and how many you think there might be to go?
Through the chair, Senator, it's a very difficult process. It happened so long ago that it's very hard to actually put all the paperwork together. And, you know, the first 75 to 100 were actually the low-hanging fruit. Those are the easy ones because you could find those very easily. There are probably only about 300 still living today. So making sure you contact them, and then the language issue of being able to communicate what you need to get the background information. Most of them don't have the Social Security number or the DD-214 or any of the forms that the Army would normally expect. So we go through a process of getting all collateral information we can from the individual, kind of build a picture to show that you really were there. And pictures are included, too. If there's a picture of the individual out there, that helps. We try to build the case through an application process that validates that this individual, with all reasonableness, did serve in the Alaska Territorial Guard. And we vet that against the list of all known that were in the Guard. And then we have a board that processes that and certifies it. And that board is in the Alaska National Guard. And then when they certify it, it comes to me for verification and to send forward to the Army. So it's a difficult process because of the time. And there are so few that are still living that then it goes into the families. And we do try to get whether they have passed on or whether they're still with us, we try to get that discharge certificate, even for those whose member is no longer with us, because it may provide some benefits to the family to be determined after we get the certificate received. So then when you get into the family, it becomes even more difficult for them to try to find any substantiation that their loved one had been in the ATG. Our team, Jerry Walton, who is my Native Government Outreach individual for the department, has been the prime leader the last 3 years, and he's the one that's really worked very well with the Native corporations, the Native organizations, to help vet these names through the communities. I would say that with no further problems, we now have a program in place where we will be able to conclude to all reasonableness, which means there will probably be some at the end of the day we'll never be able to validate. With all reasonableness, we'll be able to identify those.
And that time frame was, you said?
Initially, I had been optimistic and hoping that we could do it in a few years. I am less optimistic now because the more you go and the longer it is, the more difficult it is to get the paperwork. Our commitment, as I had as the commissioner and my team has, and I suspect the new commissioner, whenever there is one named, will continue, is we will continue this program as long as it takes until there are no more applications being filed. And I do want to thank you all, because part of what you didn't hear in the testimony is about 3 years ago, when money became the issue, I didn't go for a supplemental, but in fact you did add $50,000 to my budget each year, and we have used that to be able to process this and employ people from the state side to do the ATG outreach program. And you put in over $150,000 now, and that will continue to be in my budget. So as long as the department, the governor, and you all are in agreement, we will continue to fund that from the state level as well.
Thank you for the latitude, Madam Chair.
Again, Mr. Campbell, thank you for appearing before us today. And I want the record to reflect that we have Senator Albert Kukesh that has joined us. And now we're going to go ahead, and you can, maybe we'll get you back up here, but it's looking like your testimony is over. Betty and Richard Williams, are you on off-net, please?
Yes, I am.
Okay, would you like to go ahead and please state your name, affiliation,
yes,
and give
Betty
no
Williams.
More than a three-minute testimony?
Okay. Betty Williams, parent of a former Alaska Guardsman. You're asked why I'm testifying for my son? Because he still fears retaliation from Generals Campbell and Kakis, even though he is retiring. He'd rather just let it go, but it's us, his parents, who must get justice from these two generals. Our son is a real war hero. He is a recipient of more than 50 awards and honors, and it wasn't for sitting behind a desk plotting retaliation. Yes, he's retiring because he's fed up with the treachery from Generals Campbell and Kakis. Truth is a powerful weapon, and that's what we have on our side. Our son served two tours in Afghanistan with bravery and honor. Many guardsmen have sent in anonymous concerns to Andrew Halcrow's column and has stated that Campbell was a politician first and foremost, and that the guard was at its lowest morale in years. One told about Campbell awarding Kakis and Christensen with medals for bogus merits, which never occurred. General Campbell then opened up questions to the audience. One question came from a very brave soldier. When were the soldiers who served in Iraq and getting ready for their second tour going to get their medals for their first tour? Neither Campbell or Kakis has served in theater, yet they're awarded before the soldiers that did serve. Campbell has not walked the walk and is an opportunist politician. Upon our son's return from his second tour in Afghanistan, after being heralded the hero he was, False allegations were brought by inept and incompetent officers who had received inferior OERs from our son, who was the commander. The NATO forces didn't even want these guys serving. Generals Campbell and Kakis promoted these cronies and would not promote our son because he refused to change the OERs of the cronies. The following is an example of what they did to deserve inferior recommendations. 1, caught sleeping with a deployed enlisted soldier's wife, resulting in her pregnancy. 2, another crony alleged to have 3 DUIs. 3, another caught falsifying information on his annual review so he could be promoted. He was also found guilty of collusion of evidence with a lieutenant colonel during IGN investigation. 4, another crony, while in Afghanistan, was tried and convicted by military court using his rank to harass women. 5, a married captain while on deployment was caught sleeping with a married female major and was promoted. No punishment for any of these despicable men by the generals. This is a pattern. If you're a crony, you can allegedly get away with this type of behavior. How can Generals Campbell and Kakis be allowed to continue to cover up and promote their cronies and incompetent officers? These incompetent officers filed investigation after investigation against our son because he gave them low ratings, and the generals chose to cover up for their cronies. Our concerns? These unscrupulous officers have been promoted upon their return to Alaska and placed in positions of greater responsibility. No one was motivated to inspect or confirm these multiple allegations. Instead, the generals retaliated against our son, which we fear better not happen now, who was heralded by the news media and other generals for his performance, heroism, and initiative while in Afghanistan. The Canadians presented him one of their highest awards for his hard work, bravery, and professionalism. However, he returned to backdoor shenanigans by Campbell and Kakis, who obviously had nothing better to do than retaliate against a war hero. Our son left Alaska defeated and demoralized after being one of the most successful commanders in the southern Afghan region. He was then assigned to the National Guard Bureau, where he rose to the position of Chief of Staff for the National Guard Bureau. Again, retaliation time. Campbell and Kakis attempted to discredit him and publicly humiliate him by sending a letter to the Chief of the National Guard Bureau that they would not support our son's board for general officer. Pure, unprofessional jealousy when you see our son's performance record. This is the problem with the National Guard leadership. Integrity, they lack that, and retaliation. This arrogant general has never put his life on the line, has no combat experience, and supports yes men no matter what their credibility is. He gets paid to retaliate against decent guardsmen. How do you expect him
Mrs.
to support deployed soldiers if he's never walked the walk?
I'm sorry.
I'm just about finished. Campbell and Kakis have allowed their cronies to file investigation after investigation against our son. I would like to say this in closing, that the people of Alaska, do you want...
Mrs. Williams, are you there?
Now, my husband gets 3 minutes, doesn't he?
Yes, he has signed
here
up.
Here he is.
Well.
Here he is for his 3 minutes.
Okay, state your name, Mr. Williams, for the record and your affiliation, and please stick with the time, 3 minutes.
Yes, I'll be a little shorter since my wife went over because she covered some of the stuff I was going to cover. The main thing is General Campbell has no character whatsoever. He wrote a letter to Senator Murkowski in response to a congressional complaint. And he lied about officers were on the that was a complaint against on the same caliber as our son. And my wife went over those officers, DUIs, falsifying records, sleeping with other ones being deployed. One of them's in prison. And my son gave these officers deficient officer reporting reports because they all they said on their forward operating base complaining and whining and never went out with the troops. Even NATO troops wouldn't even work with them. In that same letter, he said the investigation was unofficial. Any letter, congressional, senatorial, IG complaint is official. And one thing you don't do, as Mr. Campbell did, he passed a preliminary report down to the troops before it was finalized and officially endorsed. He just doesn't follow regs. He's an inept man, if you want to get down to the truth. The morale in the troops is extremely low. When he took over the guard, it was in the 90% percentile of force. Now it's in the low 80s or below. promoting cronies, but passing over not only our son, but other competent officers who have been forced to get out. He's had over, our son's had over 50 awards, including high Canadian awards, National Guard, highest award given to him, and on down. He's got over 50 awards in the medals. And it's a tragedy. If you're going to have this man as a lieutenant governor, you're just shooing in the opposing party into power at the end of this term. My personal recommendation is for y'all to get an outside investigation team, come in and look at your Air Force and Army Guard, and have a competent force to follow up with their recommendations.
Okay, Mr. Williams, your 3 minutes is up. Would you close,
please? I'm through.
Okay, thank you, any questions? Mr. Williams. I'm going to allow one more opportunity since I've exhausted all names on here. Is there anyone online or in the room that would like to testify? Seeing none, I'm going to close public testimony. Again, Mr. Campbell, thank you for coming here today and answering our questions. Do I have a motion from to appoint out of state affairs?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, Madam Chair, I move Mr. Campbell's name onto the Joint Committee for confirmation as Lieutenant Governor.
Any discussion? Okay. With that, Mr. Campbell, confirmation is moved out of State Affairs, Senate State Affairs, and the meeting is adjourned.